one of the fascinating ones on the voice marketing side was I was able to come in and heavily influence them to begin testing messages, A-B split, on voice messages. Ironically, their customers are Fortune 100 customers. Fortune 100 companies often don't test at all. They'll send out flyers and direct mail, but there's no testing protocol, and they're not set up to do it. So if you said, hey, we want to split this into two and test it, they wouldn't be able to do it. They have no tracking mechanisms. It's just a competency that doesn't exist. So it was amazing how difficult it was to do something that was marketing 101 on a testing, even at the Fortune 100 level. It was fun in a way. It was a laboratory because you have these clients come in with these databases of 10 million people. You could real rapidly test when you found clients that could actually have the ability, one message against another, one approach against another. And the learning cycle was so fast on what would work when you test. You know what I mean? Because you get so much feedback so fast on not opinion, but fact.
What are some of the general things you learned when it comes to success with voice broadcasting?
First and foremost is make it sound personal. Mm-hmm. And another word we'd use is relevant. If you're contacting people that aren't your customers, you get angry hostility. If you call your customers, they love it. The other thing is that standard, and I've tested this in different not just with voice marketing, but with Salesforce and with direct mail. For Ace Hardware, we did a simple message before Thanksgiving. It kicked their sales up 48% on the day after Thanksgiving sale. And all it was we'd find voices sound like the girl next door and say, hey, just want to let you know, you're one of our better customers, and we just want to let you know there's going to be a sale on whatever. We sent you something on it. You may not have seen it, but come on in. And that's all it was.
That's great.
And it'll kick it up. Something fascinating that we discovered within that medium is that using celebrities doesn't work. We call it Julie Next Door because one of the gals that we use sounds like Julie Next Door against, of all people, John Madden. Julie kicked John's butt, and it came down to believability of your message. It's very believable that Julie from Ace Hardware gave you a call. It's not believable that John McMahon gave you a call. There's a lot of little things in that industry that wouldn't apply to a broad industry, but that we found out what would work and what wouldn't and things like that. You could reduce response on mail by using voice marketing, by actually including too much in the message. Let's say somebody sent somebody a direct mail letter. And then in the voice message, you go back and say, we sent you a letter, and inside it's going to tell you this, 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 and here's the offer. It would reduce response. And it comes down to almost like header copy on the outside of an envelope, mm-hmm. User copy. If you tell too much, there's not any reason to open the letter. So you're telling them enough to say no, but not enough to say yes.
Have you seen an increased response with the direct mail package?
Absolutely. Almost a rule of thumb, anywhere from 15 to 35%.
So what do you do? What's the message say?
It's just simple. Hi, so-and-so over here at whatever company. I just want to give you a heads up that we sent you a letter, and you usually include a benefit or something, but not specific. It includes a percentage off, or it includes a discount, or it includes a reward. Anyway, just keep an eye out for it. I didn't want you to miss it because it's real important. That alone will kick up your response. You don't need voice marketing to do that. You can have your I've actually tested that. Once it worked in voice marketing, go, hey, why wouldn't that work for a Salesforce? Or why wouldn't it work for a sales letter or mm-hmm. for a FedEx package? We'd have Salesforces. Like, say we had a white paper or a special report or something we wanted to use as a lead gen piece. And we'd just go find out. We could do it by email. Hey, we've sent you something. Keep an eye out for it. We've done pre-calling on emails.
Yep.
Yeah, just quick. Know you're busy. Wanted to let you know that sometime today you're going to be getting an email from, you know, Michael Senoff. Just wanted to let you know to keep an eye out for it. Thanks.
That's great.
That's all you need, and you're going to look at a 15 to 20% increase in how many people you contact and talk to.
Okay. Well, voice broadcasting, that could be a whole other recording we could do.
This one's right at about 7 million now after 3 years.
I'll ask you again, did you have was this just straight retainer with these two?
Yeah.
Have you made up your mind that that's going to pretty much be your model, straight retainer, just from your experiences?
Yes, unless it's a deal I can really control, the purse strings on, or really have a good trusting relationship with the person doing it.
Okay.
Because even with for example, I've got one client I've had for 10 years. You know, we can fight over stuff and disagree vehemently, and it's just the relationship. It's why it works, because we can be open and frank about stuff. But even there, if I wanted to do a joint venture with him, and I do, I absolutely trust him, but if I wanted to be absolutely sure, I still have to have the right to audit his books.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're dealing with, now you have to get an accountant, because do you want to go in and pull his books?
No.
You know, he's running a $2 million company and go through all the expenses and see where stuff moves.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets down to that relationship again on the joint ventures.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to say I'll never do one. In the right circumstances, I absolutely will.
Okay. How do you do your pricing structure with a client?
Sadly, I make it up.
You make it up. It just depends on how the potential.
Right. And one of the geniuses and why I was so interested in what Richard does, he's got a system. You come in, you look at this, you go through the USP, you go through this, you go through this. I've got intuition. I go in and dig around and find an opportunity. But it's not at all systematized like Richard's is.
What was a hot point that got you interested in Richard's thing after listening to the recordings? You've got a lot of experience in consulting and doing it, but what is it that really...
It's a systematized approach. Absolutely. I'm at a phase, I'm kind of hitting you've got X amount of time. And then also, the whole thing about the cobbler's children have no shoes. I've done a terrible job at actually marketing myself. What I've done is I get in and work with a client, they introduce me to somebody, and I've been able to have all I can handle doing that. But I've reached the point, I was a 40-year-old bachelor, married now and stuff. I'm going, you know what, we need to put some predictability into this system where I don't have to rely on referrals or this or that and my wits, but that there's a predictable system producing leads that and a way to onboard clients and explain to clients and work them through.
Right.
Anyway, that was the draw to what Richard's done.
Okay, good.
The pricing, I just take a look at it, mm-hmm. and I go, I see what they're doing, I know roughly the revenue, and I'll go, I could probably get about $2,000 a month from this person. Or I can get $4,000 or $10,000 or whatever it is a month. And that's the way I sell it. Some I've gone in on a specific project, where I'll take a look and go, well, I'll do that or write that or whatever for X amount.
So what do you say? Are you a retainer where they pay you that monthly, or do you have a minimum of 6 months, or do you change it up?
I do open-ended where they pay me monthly. So there's, I don't do contracts, and it's just like, you know, you can walk away from it anytime you want.
Meaning you don't sign a contract?
No.
You just do an agreement over the phone or in person?
Just in person.
Shake hands, and
yep.
And he writes you a check for his first month before you get to work?
Sometimes I do that, and sometimes I just bill them. Depends on, honestly, it depends. If I got a good sense for them, I'll go ahead and do 30. If I think I'm going to do a whole lot of work and maybe nothing's going to come from it, I go ahead and charge up front. I would encourage anyone that's questioning about charging up front, just to do, for example, if you're looking at a project or something, and go, great, to start this project, my standard way of operating is simply I do 50% to start and then the rest on completion or approval. That way you're getting revenue and money coming in. That has saved my bacon more than once. Because if you go in, oh, I'll do it in 30 days, you get a bunch of 30-day projects, and as you'll discover, things don't always go right. Then all of a sudden, your cash flow is dwindling down rapidly in your savings account when you're trying to get a business going. And what you find is if you say it right and nice, but matter of fact, most go, oh, okay. You would ask about some of the, you know, the bad stories, the horror stories.
Right, because you can learn from them.
Right. And, you know, I think I mentioned the one where sticking a joint venture together, and then it's worth millions. And then having one of the partners go, you know what, all he did was introduce somebody. We're not going to pay him. And again, if you learn, you learn how to posture better. Now you know that kind of stuff can happen. You know how to prevent it a little bit better and whatnot. A fun one I had, kind of fun in hindsight, was I done copied for a guy. He's selling a sports memorabilia, side jerseys and stuff. We did a thing to his customers, a letter out to his customer base. He comes back and says, I said, well, did you send it? No, we're not sending that. Well, why not? Well, I'd never send something like that to my clients. Just adamant. So I'm going, well, what's going on? He goes, just talk to my brother. And so I go talk to the brother, and the brother is sounding completely different. He's going, well, there was one sentence I didn't know if it could be phrased differently. And so I'm going, what is going on? His things went around, and I'd given this particular business owner some other stuff to look at. And he kind of put it aside and went looking. Anyway, what I discovered, he couldn't read. So he could not read. And so what he was doing is he'd hand it, and if anything was negative, he's scared to death. Because he didn't know what was being said or what was going out. The irony is this guy's making millions a year and can't read. Wow. And he completely learned to compensate for it in his life.
Yeah.
So I said, hey, you know what might help? I go, sometimes the way you read something sounds different from how it actually looks on paper. I go, would you like it at all if I read these letters to you or not? Oh, could you do that? Yeah. So we never had to admit he didn't read.
There you go. That's great.
That was a pretty out there one. We had another situation. I was doing something for a major... direct mail piece for a major investment newspaper. We had all sorts of appeals and looking at them. So the final headline copy, I forget what the actual headline was going to be, but it was going to include a photo with it, which was a guy at his desk in his corporate headquarters with his feet up on the desk with the paper covering his face. And it was going to be like, you know, who's this man and why can he make a million? Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's ready to roll. We're going forward with it. They're going to do the photo shoot. Of all things, usually it's the guy's wife that kills your copy. In this case, it was a security detail. Just that month, there had been a number of investors that had gone in and shot their advisors. I think you might have heard of them, and one of them was in Atlanta. So his security detail, even though his face wouldn't be shown, said that no part of his body could show in an ad when they were going around. So that one killed off that ad. So you just never know, you know, those out there doing it, and I'm going to come in and write this. There's just, like, so many things.
So what's the lesson that you would tell a new HMA consultant so these things don't happen? And I guess, i.e., qualifying, really making sure you're communicating to the client and identifying whether they're ready to play ball.
There's no way around. They're going to happen. For example, we modified the letter and it went, but it didn't go with the pictures and photos and stuff. This guy was actually a billionaire, so with a major corporation. Mm-hmm. So if you think you're going to go in and tell him in a security detail the way it's going to be, it's not going to happen. They just need to be psychologically ready that they're going to have a great idea, they're going to move forward, and something can come in and sideswipe it. They just need to be ready. And they'll learn what to fight for, what not to fight for with clients. Heck, I've walked in and the copy over, went in to have a final chat with it, and the owner of the company is sitting there with a pair of scissors and a little glue stick. And every line of my copy had been cut up and was all over the desk. So you work on something for hours, you think it's tight, you think it's right. You go in and there's your masterpiece cut up in ribbons with a guy with scissors and paste.
And he wanted to rearrange it.
Not only rearrange it, but he was completely rewriting stuff in between.
Wow.
And it was one of those cases where he was, sometimes your client is right.
Yeah.
This is a case where he wasn't. He just went off. But a dollar bail mailing of all things. A guy, he's a paint store, had a local paint store. I got to make sales next weekend. I got to make sales. So, okay, let's do this. Let's mail out a dollar bill. Let's use, I forget the exact wording, but it was something to the effect of, here's your first dollar off on our products at our store this weekend.
Uh-huh.
So if you come over this weekend, here's your first dollar off, and we'll be having an additional 20% off savings. Told them to send it a little invitational thing, dollar bill stapled to the top of the envelope. A week and a half later, I'm asking them what happened. Nothing. Nothing came from that. It didn't work. Really? Tell me about it. Well, it just didn't work. It was a bad idea. Okay. Can you show me, because I didn't have the time to prove it before it went out, can you show me what you sent? So, first of all, he didn't send it in invitation size. He sent it in a standard envelope with his stuff on it. Secondly, I opened it up, and I got my jaw dropped. He had photocopied the dollar bills and had pasted a photocopy of the dollar bill on the letters. At some point, you just have to have fun with it.
From your experience, what kind of businesses do you like working with related to gross volume? You like the smaller mom-and-pops or the larger ones? And what challenges?
Somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle?
By my nature, I haven't worked with a lot of retailers. I work with a lot of business-to-business or business-to-end consumer, but I have not worked with a lot of retailers other than through a client. For example, the voice marketing, where we were dealing with Fortune 100 retailers. I like them mid-size. I'm kind of like Richard. Somewhere like $500 to $5 million is nice. Once they get a marketing person in, I used to joke. I go walking into a conference room, and it had the people, and they're interviewing, and you could just feel the swords come out of the sheath when they introduced who I was and what I did. Because the marketing people, they will fight for their life. There's two things. One, they don't like you. Two, they're insecure about their job because they don't know if you're going to consult them to end up being hired. And three, they don't want to look bad. And they don't know what you're going to say. So if you work with larger companies with VPs in place or marketing directors, you just have to be very careful to take them into account, include their ideas in the thing, not threaten them, not make them look stupid in front of their boss, make them part of the final solution. But it's a heck of a lot harder. It's kind of like Albert Lasker in the old days when he used to work directly with the president of Quaker Oats or whoever else he's working with, and he got out of the business when he couldn't do that anymore and was working with managers. I like working directly with the guy that can make the decisions. We can have robust dialogue, go back and forth, and work that way. So very similar to Richard's model of who to target as a client.
Now, one of the, you mentioned something, you did something with Jay Abraham. Did you do consulting for him? Or you
two things. I set up joint ventures for his marketing seminars, like the ones you did with Tony or with Nigel Conan and such, then wrote copy.
You want to talk a little bit about some strategies?
Sure. If you're going to go, I've got about five pretty high-leverage strategies if someone's looking to. They're simple, not always easy, ways to really jolt the sales curve up. One of the first ways, it sounds kind of obvious, but it's not, and that's the answer to the question, what business are you in? There's three ways to define that. What almost everyone does is, if they make widgets, well, guess what business I'm in? I sell widgets. Later, people started to define it a bit by function, what we call an end benefit to the consumer. For example, let's take a voice marketing company as an example. They could define themselves as, we're a voice marketing company. Or they could define themselves as, we create 15 to 20% increases in sales in less than a week for Fortune 100 companies. So it's a different definition. And that definition radically alters what products you offer, what you say, what your benefits, what your USP is, just about every ounce of your marketing, everything in your manufacturing processes, everything is affected by what business you think you're in. To show the power of it, for example, this voice marketing company I've mentioned, we took a look at them. They had been defining themselves as we're a voice marketing company. Later, take a look at some of their competencies as well as and benefits they were providing. And they said, well, we're really masters at providing speed results to retailers. No one else can match what we can do result-wise. So, as soon as they went there, that opened up all new products that they could bring to the table. And one of the keys as they looked at everything, speed and results and things and customer marketing, was the database. To do what they had to do to handle databases of 10 million customers and divide them and segment them and mail them and make sure everything goes in time, they became masters at managing databases. So one of the products that they added was database management. That would have never come out if they kept defining themselves as a voice marketing company. And the database management services allowed them to get into direct mail, to email, et cetera. So it vastly expanded their ability to what they could sell to clients. This is so important. I think we mentioned earlier about the company from $7 to $25 million.
Mm-hmm.
That came about. They were a seminar company doing seminars, selling seminars, and then sometimes products. So if you ask them, what do we do? They're a seminar company. That's how they thought of themselves. I looked at it, and again, but instead of looking at the product you're delivering, and instead looking at the result you're delivering, I said, well, no, what you're doing are showing people how to increase their results and their sales and stuff. How else can we do that? And so one of the ways I got to looking was everybody buy these tape products or go to the seminars, and then they'd go out all excited and not do the results. I said, why don't we start coaching them? So we put a coaching program in place. That coaching program drove the sales because people were paying $500 a month to join that. Anyway, the coaching program drove sales from $7 to $25 million in 4 years. That became the moneymaker. And most of it went to you're hiring a couple coaches, so the labor and the cost, the manufacturing, there's nothing there. So, over half of that money is coming to the bottom line. But that happened because they saw themselves differently. And so in working with businesses, one of the things we want to look at is, what business are you really in? The leverage there affects everything. Another fast way to create results is segmentation. There's a couple ways you can look at segmentation. One is the classic, what industry are we niched in? But another one is, how do you look at your customers? Let me give you an example of a software company. They've got a software that helps mortgage lenders educate clients at the point of sale.
Mm-hmm.
And the results are fantastic from it. So we're looking at their customer base, going, well, how can we increase sales? Instead of looking at the actual messaging, what we did was look at the customer type. Some of the research was showing a lot of the people buying the product had been in the business for a year or less. So we created a segment and said, let's target people that have been in the business a year left, in addition to everything else we're doing. And so as soon as you choose a different segment like that, it blew the doors open on sales because they were able to re-message to that segment.
So is that where y'all were marketing to mainly?
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
Is that where you were focusing your marketing to that broker who's been in the business a year or less?
They had been focusing the marketing to brokers,
mm-hmm.
Technically originators, in general. But what the research showed was there was a sub-segment that had been in a year or less. So what we did was we created a whole separate marketing program to those people. So we didn't change what we were doing. We kept that revenue coming in different. And so then it became a quick start. How do you get started fast? So it created a whole, as soon as you re-segment, you have to redo your USP for that segment. So it created a whole nother additional revenue stream. Well, then we started looking and go, well, who else? Well, all these people have managers or they work for companies and have owners to deal with. So then we flipped and started targeting as another segment, a distinctive segment, brokers and owners, and using them as influencers of the sale, where they would help push the sale, or they'd buy, instead of one license, they'd buy 5 or 10 licenses. So that became a whole other revenue stream. So the segmentation thing, like even in the Fortune 500, is very powerful. Take Enterprise Car Rental. All the other car rental companies, Hertz and Avis and Budget, they're at the airport duking it out with each other over price and adding more and more features. Enterprise looked, don't know how they came up with the idea, but they said, well, how else do people use rental cars? And so they go, what about home market? And so what they came up with, people whose cars have been in wrecks and they need one. People who have a guest in town, they need an extra car.
Mm-hmm.
So they resegmented the customer. Instead of looking at airport people as the main customer segment like all the rest of the market was, they focused on our home users, we'll call it, in the local area. Right now, Enterprise is the fastest growing car rental agency.
That totally makes sense. That's why there's one right in the shopping center down the street from me.
Right. And to show the power of segmentation, just like how you define what business you're in redefines everything you do, once you look at a segment and you find one, it instantly changes the whole way you approach and do business, which is why Enterprise stuck them in shopping centers. They've got them in malls. They've got them, for example, if you go near major areas where a lot of car repair shops are, they'll have one there. By the segment, they had to completely alter their strategy and how they approached it. That's a lucrative area for a lot of companies to look at because neither they nor their competitors have looked at the segment and creatively resegmented. Anyway, there's a lot of leverage there. After segmentation, we'll call it sales process reengineering for a fancy name. A lot of times I say businesses are acting like two-year-olds. Everybody gets into business, they struggle, they kind of break through, they find a way to get customers. Well, the first way they find to get customers when they're starting out becomes the way the company markets. That's how they do it. So if it's a direct sales force, that's what they do. And that's all they know. If they started with telemarketers, well, that's what they use and that's all they know. It makes sense. You're struggling, you're trying to do it. But after you've been in business 10 years, you have so much more leverage available to you that you didn't when you started out. But people don't revisit it. Let's take, for example, a company was selling real estate education seminars to broker deal, real estate people, managers, and offices.
Mm-hmm.
And they used in telemarketing. So guess what they did? They called up, "Hi, Mike, I've got a program that will train your agents. It's a weekly program, so you have them sit down and run the videos every week, and it's $1,800. And then they just started selling. What it created was about a six-week sales cycle. And after 6 weeks, they would have closed one out of 20. I mean, not bad when you're taking that kind of approach. So we go in and work with them. I look at it. I said, What do you got? So, well, to help them make the sale, we've got this video that has examples of the segments that we send out when they won't buy.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you have? Well, and then so we kind of rummaged around. We found out that they had a management conference seminar taped. So I grabbed that. Kind of look at it, and I go, here's what we're going to do. Now, you've heard the old phrase, if you mail, you fail. It's very common in the stock industry or to any company that tells their salespeople to stop sending information. And it's like if you mail them, they're just tire kickers, they're not going to buy. But we turned that upside down, and I said, I want you to offer them something to mail. You're not going to sell them on the first call. So the call became, hi, Mr. So-and-so, I'm sitting here. We've got this package of stuff that's done, and we had a specific result that people had gotten. They doubled sales over 3 months after using the product. So we'd say, it's done this. I've got an entire package of information on that. Would you like it or not? Boom, that was it.
For free. Okay.
And a lot of them went, sure, send it. Oh, great, I'd love to send it, and let me set up an appointment, and we'll talk next. And you can tell me if you liked it or not. Just do that. So they set up appointments so that the information would go out. So then I had them go to the fax machine. This is pre-email, kind of right as it was coming in. So we went to the fax machine, and they sent a letter. Hey, Mr. So-and-so, great talking with you. I just want to let you know your package is going to go out today. Oh, by the way, here's another testimonial letter from someone that used it. I thought you might find it of interest. We sent that out. The next day, they sent another fax that said, hey, Mr. So-and-so, I checked. Your package absolutely did go out, and it'll be to you tomorrow. Oh, here's a guy that actually used the product to make a profit. I thought you might find his what he did kind of intriguing and fun. Then the day the package arrived, they got another fax. Hey, Mr. So-and-so, I'm sorry, your package is arriving. I want to make sure that you had your secretary look out for it, and I'm looking forward to talking with you on whatever the calendar date was they had the appointment for. Then the package. What I did was wrote a sales letter. They'd never had a sales letter for this product. So I wrote a salesman in an envelope letter for them. Then we included, if you call me first, I'm going to include this, and it was a $349 bonus of the seminar, the manager seminar in it. That was the offer. So they send this out. A few days later, one of the salesmen comes in glowing. He's going, I got the credit card for $1,800. He called me. And all he did was say, okay, I want the package. What credit card? Here's my credit card number. That was the sale. In 2 weeks, they went from selling 1 out of 20 over 6 weeks to selling...
This is the end of part 2. I hope you're enjoying this exclusive training for HMA consultants. Please continue to part 2. 3. If you go back to my site and in the products page along the light blue section down on the left, you're going to see another link that has a lot of value, and it all has to do with joint ventures. Go to that page and you're going to hear about an offer on a joint venture system like no other. If you read the letter there, it'll describe all the benefits, and the offer is virtually risk-free, meaning you can order my joint venture system, have it sent to you without paying a dime, have 30 days to review it, to digest all the information, and only if you're happy with it after 30 days do you pay. It's an offer you can't lose on, and if you're enjoying this content, you're really going to love what I have waiting for you on the joint venture link at the products page at hardtofindseminars.com. Go check it out. I think you'll really enjoy it.